The back booth of Salome's Diner in Philadelphia has become a hotbed of music criticism.
Oh, good morning and good day. Here we are once again, breakfast at Salome's, home of that bargain breakfast and all the hottest hits.
Breakfast at Salome's is a music review show. You can see it on the internet. NPR's Zoe Chace visited Salome's and sat down to talk with the show's unlikely hosts.
My name's Bill Abel. I'm 75, resident of Fishtown all my life.
I'm Ann Bailey. I've lived in Fishtown for 66 years now.
I'm Joe Walker. I am 84 years old, hoping to be 85 on the 1st of August.
These guys are fixtures of Fishtown, one of those rough around the edges, blue-collar Philly neighborhoods.
They asked me to critique music that I know nothing about.
I really like the new music. It's really not bad.
It is the music of the age. It is the music of the young people. And it's what they're going to remember 20 years from now with nostalgia. I don't know how, because it really doesn't appeal to me. But I try hard to listen to it and give a honest review.
Bill, Ann, and Joe have gone totally viral. You can find the reviews posted on YouTube about every other week.
Welcome to Breakfast at Salome's, where we still have those breakfast specials and tote tap and pancakes. We're going to hear two ditties today from Flo Rida and Gemini Wolf. Would you like to take the first one, Bill?
Oh, geez, I didn't know I was here. Okay.
The man behind the camera is Mark Brodzik of Woodshop Films. He came to Salome's regularly for the pancakes.
And there would be these three or four characters that would, one would be sitting at the counter, one would be sitting in the booth, and another in another booth.
Discussing the affairs of the world, the Phillies, and different things, and he was dazzled by the wit and humor and the erudition, and he decided to put it on tape. He thought it would be something that other people would be interested in and love us as, you know, the people around here do. It sort of caught on.
Their audience is small but influential. Music review site Pitchfork has noticed, so has Philadelphia Weekly, The New Yorker Sasha Frera Jones. They're all impressed with the old-timers' brevity. This is the way a typical production works. Brodzik chooses the music, sits the three in the back, and films their unscripted response.
Starting to get a headache.
There you go.
This is their review of a single from Animal Collective called My Girls.
Oh, God. Is that the music? That's it? The lyrics were too repetitious. It's as bad as Rocket Man, who must sing that about 30 times.
I think that, you know, they introduced that theme, that monotonous thing early on, and I don't think they should have sustained it through the entire recording. They mm-hmm. should have cut it off after about four bars.
Mm-hmm.
I doubt that this group is going to get very far from Baltimore, Maryland.
I think some of their reviews are actually really brave.
Brian McManus, music editor with Philadelphia Weekly.
I think that there's kind of a community of critics, and we all live within a bubble. If something's really critically lauded and you don't like it, it's kind of scary to say sometimes. Like, if you don't like the new Animal Collective, it might be kind of a scary thing to say in front of, like, critical company. And I think that's what makes Salome's great, is that they come with none of that baggage.
Ann Bailey, Joe Walker, and Bill Abel actually don't have much good to say about the new music, as they call it. Despite that, indie bands like the Fiery Furnaces, Harvey Milk, and others coming through Philly vie to get on the show. Rolling Stone, The Apollo, Def Jam Records now add the back booth at Salome's to the list. For NPR News, I'm Zoe Chace.
The annual summit of the Group of Eight industrialized countries opens Wednesday in Italy. But as NPR Silvia Poggioli reports in this letter from Europe, the agenda risks being overshadowed by sex scandals swirling around the host, Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi.
The slogan of this G8 is sobriety, a quality not usually associated with Italy's media mogul turned political leader. For the last 2 months, allegations have been made about Berlusconi's relationship with an underage teenager who calls him daddy, that he turned favorite starlets into political candidates and entertained high-end prostitutes. Newspapers have printed photos showing topless women at his sumptuous Sardinian villa. Prosecutors are probing alleged payments made to several women recruited to attend his parties. Some of the women may have ties to the mafia. One call girl has given reporters graphic details of her alleged encounter in bed with the prime minister the night of the U.S. presidential election, and she says she has tapes to prove it. Coverage of the scandals has been limited to newspapers not controlled by Berlusconi, which means that 80% of Italians who get their news only from his own TV networks or state-run channels have little or no knowledge of the revelations. The European media, on the other hand, have been relentless in covering the Berlusconi sex saga. And even traditionally blasé Europeans are stunned by seamy tales of the premier's womanizing and hedonistic parties. British, French, Spanish, and German editorialists have called him a clown, an aging Lothario, a danger for Italian democracy, and compared him to decadent Roman emperors. Berlusconi has reacted defiantly. He dismisses the allegations as concoctions of a communist-led conspiracy that has recruited the likes of the Financial Times and The Economist. After a long silence, some prominent figures of the Catholic Church, one of Berlusconi's staunchest supporters, began to issue stern comments about moral decadence and even suggested he resign. This is not Berlusconi's first time in a negative spotlight. In his 15 years in public office, he has survived accusations of mafia ties, numerous corruption charges, and serial conflicts of interest. And he can count on the support of nearly 50% of Italian voters. But his international image has been badly tarnished. In the first organized protest against Berlusconi's sexgate, a group of Italian women academics is appealing for solidarity outside of Italy. Their petition says Berlusconi's near total control of Italian TV severely restricts freedom of speech and urges the G8 first ladies to boycott the summit on the grounds the prime minister's behavior offends the dignity of all women. Silvia Poggioli, NPR News, Rome.
The image of Monticello, the home of Thomas Jefferson, has graced the reverse side of the American nickel for most of the past century. The domed roof, the four columns beneath, and the pavilions extending from the center like a pair of open arms are an impressive sight. Last month, I visited this majestic estate atop a mountain near Charlottesville, Virginia, for the first time. The house is a testament to the architectural genius of America's third president. But that's not all there is. When I wandered down a small hill on one side of the mansion, I found another testament to Jefferson's genius, a lush green and long rectangle filled with perfectly straight rows of countless plants.
This was the main vegetable garden. He started it at 690-something feet long, and it's about 40 feet wide. And he divided it into 24 rectangular plots. And Jefferson's one of these people where everything had to be amazingly precisely measured and squared off and so on. And there were plans from the years right through towards his death of where everything should be planted in the rows in the plots.
Keith Thompson is the author of a book called A Passion for Nature: Thomas Jefferson and Natural History. I met him on the day of my visit to talk about the garden that illustrates the third president's passion. We sat in a small brick pavilion in the middle of the garden and looked across the rows.
It was basically divided in his day between what he called the fruits, which was things like peas, peppers, and so on, and the root vegetables, and then the leafy vegetables. But the distinction was never quite that precise. But it is, I think, it's one of the most extraordinary gardens that exists anywhere.
And on the other side of the garden, we're looking out toward the wonderful, the valley.
We're on the top of a 1,000-foot mountain, Monticello, little mountain. He used to come here and read and survey everything. And I must admit, I can't imagine anything better than having a pavilion in one's garden where you can look from the top of a mountain to survey a lot of stuff you actually owned.
Thomas Jefferson, this garden, I mean, this was designed to feed the people who lived and worked here.
Indeed, yes, and it was a large number of people. He had his two daughters and tons of grandchildren, and when he stopped being president, every day there were hangers-on coming by and people would arrive from Europe and come to visit unannounced.
And they had to be fed.
It used to drive him crazy.
Thomas Jefferson built and rebuilt Monticello over the course of 40 years. He was an architect. He designed the University of Virginia as well as Monticello. He was a politician, governor of Virginia, congressman, secretary of state, and, of course, president. He was an inventor. And in an age before the word was a term of art, Thomas Jefferson was a scientist. He loved to tinker, to create, and to experiment.
Everything he grew in this garden was a result of an experiment. If he didn't like a variety, he would just throw it out. I suppose one way to answer the question is to say what were some of the failures.
Yeah.
He was very enthusiastic about the sugar maple as a way of getting sugar without having to import it from the West Indies. So he tried sugar maples here, but the climate is not quite right. They tried grapes. And for some reason or other, which is odd because Virginia now is a major wine-growing part of the eastern United States, they could not establish a really good vinery.
When did he have time to garden?
Well, this is extraordinary. When did Jefferson have time? I mean, he was always doing five things extremely well. When did he have time to do them? Well, I think the fact is that he didn't garden so much as tell people what to grow, and they tended it.
Most of the work was done by slaves. They planted the leafy greens and root vegetables, as well as the fruits and herbs, in precise rows, side by side, along the length of the garden terrace.
What was Thomas Jefferson's philosophy about space? I mean, it's just interesting that this vegetable garden is so very formal and rectangular.
Yes.
And we haven't seen the flower garden yet. But I understand that it's designed completely differently.
It is, yes.
Did he have sort of contrasting ideas about space?
So much about Jefferson is sort of contrasting, and you think you've got a grasp on him, and then you realize he's wriggled away. On this side of the house where it's all functional, it's all extremely ordered and tidy and in mathematical rows, and that's exactly what you want to do if you're going to control nature. And remember, this was the wilderness. This was a mountaintop in the forest, and except where people had cut out fields, it was forest from here as far as you went west. So controlling nature was terribly important. But around the house itself, here he wants to have a continued sense of the wilderness. He's very careful about shaping what looks like wilderness, but is actually a very controlled, romantic environment where there is not one single straight line.
I read in your book that Thomas Jefferson's favorite vegetable was the pea.
The pea, yes.
Really?
Yes, and this is one of the things that he really experimented with. And Ledman's Dwarf was the variety that he liked most. And this is a very good climate for growing peas, I must say.
And this isn't
a short
pea
season. I can't see any peas from where we're standing at the moment.
No,
I see.
What are we? Let's see what we're looking at. Those look like carrots.
That surely is carrots.
Scarlet horn carrot.
Yes. And this is oregano or marjoram.
Uh huh.
And behind it is some kind of
vine.
That must be a.
Be
that
a
might
pea?
Be a pea. Yes. They all. Oh no, it's a bean.
They're such perfect rows. I mean, they're just so. It's mathematically just. Straight.
Right, and this is we're now at the end of the vegetable garden, and we can cut across into the distant part of the flower garden.
The contrast between Thomas Jefferson's vegetable garden and his flower gardens is remarkable. Instead of rigid mathematical rows, there are soft curves, winding walks, and bright, fragrant flowers.
So now you see
it's a wonderful oval.
Yeah, and you see how funnily all the straight lines that are in the house somehow go perfectly well with the straight lines in the vegetable garden, and yet the curves go well with the sort of large oval walk. As you see, no straight lines in here.
None at all. Look at this. An amaranthus, love lies bleeding. Asters, pink, I think.
Yep, delphinium.
Asters, straw flowers.
That straw flower.
Name that plant.
Name that plant, yes. So now we're coming to the house itself, which is built in this U shape, the main house in the middle, and then the ends of the two arms, these pavilions.
Monticello was the laboratory for many of Jefferson's inventions. The great clock, driven by cannonball weights, which hang on either side of the front door. The polygraph sits on his desk. When Jefferson wrote, his pen would be attached to a device with several arms, each with another pen hovering over a piece of paper. So copies of a document were made as it was being written. Jefferson also designed a revolving bookstand that allowed him to consult 5 books at once. The diverse interests of this Renaissance man enabled him to design a house, fill it full of inventions, then masterfully sculpt the landscape surrounding it. Thomas Jefferson expressed and fulfilled his passion for nature through the gardens at Monticello, and he spent as much time outdoors as he could.
Whenever he was not in office somewhere, he would ride his horse 2 or 3 hours every day, supervising everything, singing. And then the pavilion where we were, he would sit out there and read. And when he was stuck in Washington and in Philadelphia and in Paris, he just hated it. He really wanted to be back here at his little mountain.
Keith Thompson, author of the book A Passion for Nature, Thomas Jefferson and Natural History. Our visit to Monticello, the Founding Fathers' Little Mountain, was produced by Sarah Beyer Kelly, and there are pictures of Thomas Jefferson's garden at npr.org.
It's been 16 years since rare and endangered clouded leopards have been born at the National Zoo's Conservation and Research Center in Front Royal, Virginia. But it finally happened again this past March when a sleek and mysterious leopard named Zhao Chu gave birth to 2 male cubs. And the center recently allowed us to meet Mom, Dad, and the babies.
Hey, dudes. Male and the female have been put together already this morning.
This morning, like every morning, Ken Lang, the mammal supervisor here, greets Zhao Chu and her husband, Hannibal.
Ow. Ow. Ow.
Hannibal brushes up against the metal cage as Lang walks by. Zhao Chu, elegant and poised, lounges on a wooden branch inside. A combination of deforestation and hunting has left fewer than 10,000 clouded leopards in the wild. And for researchers, these leopards are among the most elusive and mysterious felines. Why do we know so little about these animals?
Their habitat. They're coming from tropical rainforests, very mountainous areas in some cases.
Southern China and Thailand.
Yeah, all of Southeast Asia. And the few that have been caught and radio collared, they really haven't been able to find out much data. They can say, yes, the cat's someplace within 10 or 15 feet of us, but the jungle's so thick, they don't even see the cat again.
For years, Dr. Joe Gale Howard struggled to understand why it was nearly impossible to get adult clouded leopards to breed.
You can put these animals side by side in a enclosure where they can see each other every day. Sometimes it's very overt aggression. It's very obvious they're not going to get along. Sometimes it's not so obvious, and when we open the door and try to pair them, he would just go after her immediately and kill her. It's happened many times.
2 years ago, Howard oversaw a revolutionary experiment. She decided to introduce Hannibal and Zhao Chu to one another as cubs. They were just 6 months old at the time. The experiment was to find out whether raising them together from a young age might encourage them to mate. It worked, and just a few cages away from Zhao Chu and Hannibal's lair, we meet their children.
Oh. Hello.
Quite formed, is that?
The two male cubs, each the size of a full-grown house cat, are still fuzzy like baby ducklings. It'll take a while before they wear the sleek, shiny coat of a grown-up leopard. For now, their interests are wrestling and gnawing on Ken Lang's leather boots. But cute as they are, these cubs are also vital to the species' survival. The trick for Joe Gale Howard was to find a compatible female cub somewhere in the world, before it was too late.
The minute they were born, we knew we had to start looking for a mate.
The clock was ticking, essentially.
The clock started ticking.
How much time did you have?
Well, we knew we had about 6 months to figure this out. And we also knew there had been no births in North America in so many years. There weren't any cubs born.
You have 6 months because if you don't introduce them before that...
We knew we had the best chance of success of creating pairs, breeding pairs, if we mated this guy, say, up with a female when he was 6 months of age. You can do it older. You can do it even up to 12 months. And literally what happens is once they go through puberty, that's when they change and they get high testosterone, and that's when they have the potential of killing a female. And that's probably why it works so well, is when you introduce them to their future mate at a young age, they're just playmates. But then they grow up, they're compatible, they bond to each other, and then they eventually breed.
And just as luck would have it, another litter was born just a month ago at the Nashville Zoo. And among those babies is a female. Once she reaches 6 months of age, Nashville zoologists will send her to Front Royal, Virginia to meet the two boys born there. She'll have her choice to pick which one she likes better. And hopefully, within the next 2 years, another litter will arrive. We got to go inside the cage with the cubs and shoot some photos and video. If you'd like to see them or to learn more about the National Zoo's Conservation and Research Center, visit npr.org.
At the beginning of 2009, many Americans feared that a real economic depression was at hand. In January alone, U.S. employers slashed nearly 750,000 jobs. As we move into the second half of the year, the economy remains in deep trouble, but the sense of panic has been easing. The banking system appears to be stabilizing, and existing home sales have been inching back up. So what's the outlook for 2009's second half? Joining us to assess where we are in this long and painful recession is NPR Senior Business Editor Marilyn Geewax. Welcome back, Marilyn.
Good morning, Leanne.
As I mentioned, we're at the midpoint of 2009, but where are we exactly in this recession? Can we safely say that we're near the end?
Compared with where we were 6 months ago, it'd be fair to say that the economy is better. Most economists think that we're at about the end of the recession. It's ending sometime this summer. And compared with January, you know, remember then we had everything falling, jobs, profits. Every measure you could think of was collapsing, and people were actually fearing that by this summer we could see even civil unrest in the streets. So that kind of panicky feeling is really fading. But the economy's still lousy. This last week we saw the Labor Department said that in June employers cut nearly 500,000 jobs. Well, okay, that's better than January, but it's still shockingly high. We really need to get back to job growth, and we're a long way from that.
There were also a lot of fears about the housing market as property values plummeted, mortgages became harder to get. How is the housing market doing now?
Well, we're not seeing the home prices plunging the way they were. In some communities, prices are stabilizing or maybe dropping just a little bit. The industry has come up with data that shows existing home sales are starting to move up just a little bit. But by any realistic measure, the housing market is still terrible. Home prices are about a third below where they were in 2006, and our foreclosure rate is still continuing to rise.
Are you able to tell what's likely to happen to the economy in the second half of this year?
Well, if we turn to the optimists, some are pretty optimistic about a quick snapback. They think there's a lot of pent-up demand out there for cars and homes and other items. And then there are some real pessimists who say, you know, look, we've still got nearly 15 million Americans looking for work right now. And that big drag on the economy is scary. It could cause an increase in credit card default rates. It could spike home foreclosures again. And there's a lot of fear out there that we haven't seen the worst of it yet with commercial real estate, that could fall pretty hard. But I'd say most of the economists are somewhere in the middle. The conventional wisdom is that we're digging our way out of this hole, though very slowly. I think that we can probably count on a little bit of a glow during the holiday season, but I don't think anybody can really look for fireworks by New Year's. Most people expect about 2% growth by the end of the year, maybe a little better than that, but certainly not robust 4% growth.
Let's say you're one of those mildly optimistic people. You have a job, you have a little money to invest. Is it safe to get back into the stock market?
Well, Leanne, I'm not a forecaster myself, but I do listen to what knowledgeable people on Wall Street have been saying. And I think in the last 2 months, there was a pretty good feeling about where stock prices were heading. By the end of June, we saw that stock prices were up a lot from their depths in March. But this latest job news has got people's nerves jangled again. So now the outlook's pretty mixed. I think everybody's just going to be watching for those corporate earnings that'll be coming out in coming weeks. The quarter just ended June 30th, and there's a feeling that with companies cutting labor costs so much that maybe profitability is up. So if we start to see in coming weeks that profits are good, then maybe the optimists are right and stocks will perk up.
Well, we'll be watching closely, too, and we'll have a lot more questions for you to answer. And we'd like to get some of those questions from our listeners. If you have a question for Marilyn or a suggestion for a topic you'd like to hear more about, send your suggestions to our blog, npr.org/soapbox. Marilyn G. Wax is NPR's Senior Business Editor. Thanks again, Marilyn.
You're welcome, Leanne.
The White House has announced another summit being held this week. Top cabinet officials will meet Thursday at the National Institutes of Health to discuss swine flu. Swine flu has mostly disappeared from the headlines, but last month the World Health Organization declared it the first flu pandemic since 1968. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says that it's likely well over a million Americans have been infected so far. But NPR's Richard Knox told me the official number of cases in the states is something like 28,000.
But that doesn't really mean much because that's just the number of people who've been tested and have been confirmed. And they know that a lot of people didn't get tested. They're not even testing anymore because they assume that whatever flu is out there, and there still is quite a lot out there, even though it's no longer flu season, is this new flu.
Well, obviously, it's summertime here in the Northern Hemisphere. What's going on in the Southern Hemisphere where they're going through winter right now?
It's picking up. Their flu season is well underway, and it's expected to peak in this month and probably in August. The hot spots are Chile, which has more than 6,000 cases now.
Wow.
Argentina has 1,600. Brazil has about 700. And again, these counted cases are just a rough indicator of what's really out there. Interestingly, Argentina, which has about 40% of the cases that Chile does, has more than twice as many deaths. Nobody knows exactly why.
And what about in Africa, Dick?
So far, very few cases. Egypt has maybe 70, and sub-Saharan Africa, just a few cases here or there. For instance, only one in South Africa. And the CDC people say that so far there really isn't a whole lot of flu there, but they're very nervous about it because there are millions and millions of people who have HIV, who have TB, have malaria, have poor nutrition, who are at very high risk of dying.
Dick, what are public health experts in this country saying about the coming flu season?
They expect a whole lot more flu than the normal flu season. They expect more people will not only get sick but have severe disease and more people will die. And the reason for that is that even if this new virus does not change at all over the coming months, 70% of the population, that is to say people under the age of about 52, have no immunity at all to it. They've never seen a virus like this before. The people who are older than 50 or so are thought to have some kind of protection by virtue of being exposed to similar viruses in the past that haven't circulated in this country for a long time.
So what are their options? I mean, is there any talk of a vaccine being ready in time?
Oh, yeah. They're working really hard. The manufacturers of flu vaccines expect to begin sometime pretty soon testing for safety and efficacy. By the end of the summer, they'll have to make a big decision about whether to go ahead and crank it out and try to vaccinate 304 million Americans or however many we can do. It's going to be a monumental task. First of all, this new vaccine will probably require two doses because it is a new vaccine. Secondly, they'll have to decide whether also to vaccinate people against seasonal flu viruses because it's expected that they may be circulating at the same time as this new virus.
NPR's Richard Knox has been covering the swine flu pandemic. Dick, thanks so much.
You're welcome.